I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. In his latest book, CNN commentator Van Jones calls for a politics of confession. He argues that despite deep divides in the American body politic, achieving consensus on important issues is possible. Jones says that we can come together around a shared value of American exceptionalism and through common pain, find common purpose. The book is a clarion call to progressives and conservatives alike to find those issues, perhaps something like criminal justice reform, where there is growing agreement about the need for change and the way forward. The book is called The Messy Truth: How We Came Apart, How We Come Together. Van Jones is my guest today on Midday, right after these headlines. Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Hope you had a good weekend, and very glad that you've chosen to join us this afternoon. In his third book, published last week, Van Jones asserts that even in our current climate of strident bifurcation in the political arena, there are some issues about which voters and leaders of all political stripes can agree. Common pain should lead to common purpose, he writes. He criticizes both major political parties for letting down America time and time again, and he suggests that a rebellion, like the one we witnessed last November, was justified. A dedicated Democrat, he just thinks the wrong rebel won. Van Jones is a Yale-educated lawyer and the founder of several social justice organizations, as well as a commentator and host on CNN. The book is called Beyond the Messy Truth: How We Came Apart, How We Come Together. Van Jones, welcome to Midday. Appreciate your time.
Oh, I'm so glad to be here.
So this is a very hopeful book, and it's hopeful at a time when people who have hope may be in the vast minority. There is this pallor that has set in, certainly among people on the left, since the election. I wonder, why do you start with the premise that comity, that agreement, in fact, can be achieved? What fundamentally gives you the optimism that that's the case?
Well, let me just say a few things right up front. One, I am virulently anti-Trump. I was screaming in June, May of the election year, when everybody was laughing and saying, "Oh, the Republicans have really done themselves in. They've nominated this joke candidate." I was screaming, "This guy can win. He has a clear pathway to win." And we didn't. When we had the opportunity to stop him, we didn't. And so, because I think we took him a little bit too lightly. And now I think that people have gone from thinking, "Oh, he's a joke, he'll never win, it's impossible," to thinking, you know, this is the end of America. And I just think that we underreacted, now we're overreacting. Here's the reality. The problem is not just that we have too many bad people doing bad things. We definitely have too many bad people doing bad things. The real problem is the good people, who greatly outnumber the bad people, just don't know what to do yet. And so I wrote this book. Really, it's kind of a tough love letter to both parties. And to say, look, guys, we got to look in the mirror here. Both sides have been letting down our base voters for a long time. We haven't been doing right. But a whole third of the book is literally just resources that people can access, groups they can support on both sides, documentaries you can watch, podcasts. If you're trying to understand what's going on, the book tries to give you some resources, as well as some arguments and some ideas, so that, you know, we always say, you know, Donald Trump is crazy. Well, I think there's plenty of evidence of that. But the other crazy is to keep doing the same thing over and over again on the left and expecting a different outcome. For 2 years now, we've just been, you know, outraged and upset and pointing out all the ways that he's, you know, terrible. What we haven't done yet, and I think we have the opportunity to do now, is to self-reflect a little bit, ask ourselves, what are the things that we could have done better? And then starting now to do the things that will reach out, that will re-energize our own base, cut into his support, de-inflame some of this stuff, so this never happens again.
A few months back, I interviewed a couple of reporters, one from Roll Call, one from The Hill, John Allen and Amy Parnes. They wrote a book called Shattered, which was a chronicle of the Hillary Clinton campaign. And they talked about the Clinton decision early on to not really fundamentally try to persuade Trump voters that they should vote for Secretary Clinton, that they were sort of out of the persuasion business and they were simply in the business of rounding up and making sure that they turned out the vote for the people who are already with them. 84% of Republicans think that President Trump is fit for office and doing a good job. You know, yes. 94% of Democrats think that's not the case. 94% of African Americans think, when you start, you know, parsing the various groups, 94% of African Americans do not think he is fit for office. How right. do you bring 94% of Black folks and 84% of the Republican Party together when the divide is that vast?
Well, listen, there are some things we're just going to have to fight about, and we're just not going to agree, and that's all right. That's, you know, democracy means you get to disagree. Dictatorship, you can't disagree. Democracy, you get to disagree. And there are some issues we're just going to fight about. We're not going to abandon Muslims, who, as best I can tell, are like the best Americans that we've got. I mean, you've got the lowest crime rate, the lowest divorce rate, the highest entrepreneurship rate, one of the highest educational attainment for women. Every Muslim I know has got a job or a college degree or a business. Why we should be attacking Muslims, I have no idea. We're not going to abandon transgender folks. You got transgender people in the military. I'm scared to go. If you will wait for me to defend America, you're going to wait a long time. I'm proud of them for stepping up. So you've got a lot of stuff that we're not going to go backwards on. We just have to fight. But you can't only fight and still have a country. And the problem I think that everybody's forgetting on both sides is that democracies can fail. America is hard to do. You've got 300 million people in one country trying to be a democracy with every color, every class, every faith, every sexuality, every gender, every kind of human being ever born in one country. Nobody's ever been crazy enough in 10,000 years of human history to even try this. And so you can't only fight and still have a country. So even while we fight, we've got to find those areas where we can actually continue to work together, de-inflame some of the tension. You know, this addiction crisis, this opioid painkiller crisis, which killed, you know, one of my close friends, Prince, the late rock star, but it's also killing coal miners and killing people across the country. More people dying of this opioid epidemic than were dying at the height of the AIDS crisis in the 1980s. Everybody knows it's terrible, and we're not doing enough about it. And yet, you know, I include in the book really simple things that we could be doing to bring the numbers way down and change the drug courts. Why aren't we working together on that? Criminal justice reform. You know, we're arguing about cabinet taking a knee and free speech for athletes and whether somebody like doesn't like our soldiers. No athletes ever said anything bad about our soldiers. This whole thing is stupid. When both parties agree that we could make our court system and our criminal justice system much better, and in fact, Republican governors have been leading the way. Rick Perry, a conservative Republican governor of Texas at that time, closed three prisons and brought the crime rate down. Same for Governor Deal in Georgia. Same for Governor Kasich in Ohio. Well, you know, there's an area of agreement. Everybody agrees that we're not preparing our young people for the jobs of tomorrow with artificial intelligence and robotics. Whether you believe in vouchers or charter schools or stronger public education, there should be curricular reform to get our kids ready for tomorrow. These are things that are, I mean, the overlap in terms of concern is extraordinary, but we're so busy being traumatized and re-traumatized and outraged by every tweet from this orange weirdo that we aren't even doing the things that we could be doing. And so what I'm pointing out in the book is we have to fight on these areas where we cannot compromise on basic human rights. We'll fight till the last dog barks, but let's fight from 9 to noon. And then maybe from noon to 3, get something done for everybody so we can still have a country.
I think that critique is absolutely valid and persuasive, that there are things where there's people on the left and the right. We've got, you know, Rand Paul and Cory Booker proposing legislation together about mass incarceration. I mean, there are certain areas. What there isn't it seems to me, is an understanding that working across the aisle is a good thing. People, point to Mitch McConnell when Barack Obama was elected, saying we're just going to do everything we can to impose him, and no is going to be the word of the day, and they kept that word of the day for 8 years. You say that you're looking for the moral center, not the political center. And I wonder, I mean, isn't that what Barack Obama was running on? We're not red states, we're not blue states, we're the United States. And then the notion of morality. I mean, there's Karl Rove with his moral formulation of the moral majority of the evangelical left. Can we even agree on what a moral center would be, and how is that distinct from a political center?
Well, yes, I confess that I am a follower of Obama and her husband, by the way. I'm a follower of Obama and her husband. I'm a follower of both Obamas. And when Michelle Obama said, when they go low, we go high, nobody at the time said that she was crazy or she was an appeaser or that she was going to usher in Hitler, because that's who we are. And I'm just going to tell, you got probably, a bunch of liberals and progressives here. I'm just going to, I hate to disappoint folks. We are not going to be able to out-ugly Donald Trump. It's just not possible. We're not going to be able to out-hate, these neo-Nazis. We're just not good at it. We're too sensitive. We care about too many people. We can't be pulled into their game. Doesn't mean you don't fight hard, but we won two elections with that, with that basic sense of inclusion. That basic sense that America is great and could be greater. And I just don't think it makes a lot of sense to throw it in a garbage can because we got some weird dude with, narcissistic Twitter addiction. I mean, I just don't think that it's not enough for us to throw it in a garbage can. Let me show you where there's actual hope. First of all, don't forget that we didn't fight hard in 2016. I mean, part of the problem is we keep acting like, we went out there and fought and we were beaten by these horrific people. Guys, quit the nonsense. I know how hard we worked in 2008. Everybody I know was going to swing states. We were doing phone banks. We were doing, potluck suppers. We were doing everything we could. 2012, the same thing, to stop McCain and Romney. 2016, we took it so lightly. We were in that Obama bubble bath for 8 years, and when a real fight came, we got up and we were wrinkly and weak and we weren't really prepared to fight, and nobody told us that we were going to have to fight. And so the reality is, if you look at there's hope here because we didn't do all that we could do. You were talking about it was going to be a not a persuasion election, but a mobilization election. Well, I think that's a bad strategy, but it was a bad strategy poorly implemented. I show in the book, I go to Michigan and I talk to the grassroots folks in Michigan where we got beaten. And they never got support from the party because the data dummies who run this party they looked at their data and said, well, Michigan's in the bag. And they never invested in the grassroots. So we didn't do persuasion or mobilization in Michigan, in Indiana, in Ohio, in Wisconsin. So once you realize, oh, wait a minute, there's stuff we could have done better. And by the way, there is a reason to reach out to people who are Trump voters. I don't think we should give Trump a single person. Just because 60 million people voted for him, I want him to have to fight for every one of them every day. We didn't have that attitude in 2016, and now we're paying the price. But don't give up on who we are. And frankly, if you're a conservative, your party is infinitely better than this guy. Don't give up on the principles and the values. You would expect conservatives to be the first one telling a president to keep his nose out of private business, whether it's, the NFL or the mainstream media. You'd expect conservatives to be the first one to defend the country from foreign attack, with the Russians trying to disrupt our democracy. So I don't want the conservatives to stop being conservatives and become liberals. We need left and right. I've never seen a bird fly with only one wing, a left wing or a right wing. You need both wings. But I need the conservatives to be better conservatives. I need the Republicans to vote for better Republicans. And frankly, as progressives, we need to be better progressives and really empower our base, our African-American, Latino, female, et cetera, base, really empower, really invest, and also broaden our circle to include folks who are hurting, who may be white and male and Christian and living in red states, but who have issues and problems and pain that we should take seriously.
Van Jones, the new book is called Beyond the Messy Truth, How We Came Apart, How We Come Together. We'll have more with Van Jones when we come back after a quick break, and we will take your phone calls, emails, and tweets. Our number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Find us on Twitter, @MiddayTomHall. We're glad you're with us. Stick around. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, we're going to spend the hour with the Pulitzer Prize-winning author Elizabeth Strout. She's the author of Olive Kittredge, which was made into a terrific series on HBO a few years back. Another one of my favorites is her book called My Name is Lucy Barton. I'm very much looking forward to meeting Elizabeth Strout tomorrow and introducing her to you. That's coming up on Midday at noon. On Tuesday, if you've just joined us today, my guest is the CNN commentator and show host Van Jones. We're talking about his latest book, The Messy Truth, How We Came Apart, How We Come Together. You can join us at 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, and to send us a tweet, @MiddayTomHall. So, Van, before the break, you make the point, which I think is absolutely another valid assertion, that we'd expect conservatives to, want the government to stay out of private businesses like the NFL and or the news business and that kind of thing. You'd also expect conservatives, Republicans and Democrats, to cling to power when power was in their grasp. And there's so few people. The only people who are really disowning Mr. Trump are the ones who are leaving government, Bob Corker being the most recent and salient example. When it comes to this persuasion and your point about the mobilization that the Clinton campaign attempted and failed at is also a good one. But when it comes to persuasion, is there any room for persuasion at all? Or do we just simply look to places like the opioid epidemic or prison reform or criminal justice reform where it appears there's already some agreement? I mean, what is the premise by which we can begin to tell people fitness for office matters, policies that affect so many people in a negative way matter, and bring people to an understanding and even an agreement with views that are more to the left side of the spectrum?
Well, I mean, the premise of your question is that the most important thing we need to do is to convince people to agree with us, that we're right and the other people are wrong. So the only question is, how do we get the people who are wrong to agree with us? That's actually a part of the problem, is that the entire national discourse now boils down to, I'm right and you're wrong. Or worse, we're right and they're wrong. We're talking about each other, not even talking to each other.
Well, if I could just interrupt for a second. It's not necessarily just a matter of right and wrong. It's also a matter of how we form, and you write about this, about how we form allegiances with people who are even, you know, traditionally people who are who have been in the Democratic camp. You make the statement that progressives are better at embracing the historically marginalized and not the newly marginalized. So in what ways could we embrace or what ways did we not embrace, and I say we meaning the progressive left, people like the coal miners? I mean, when Hillary Clinton told them, look, the coal mines are not going to operate the way they did in the past, and so we're going to embrace you by helping you get training in other industries and for other skills, isn't that a way of embracing them, or was that just the wrong way of embracing them?
You know, there's a way that Democrats are very, very intelligent. Often, those of us who are really involved, very intelligent, very smart. You know, we've gone to good schools. We obsess about policy, but we're not as emotionally intelligent as we need to be. And I think that's an area where we might need to grow a little bit. I think that I spent a lot of time in West Virginia. Actually, one of my bigger campaigns this year, when I'm not on TV, I actually work for something called the Dream Corps. And the Dream Corps supports a number of different campaigns, including the Love Army, the lovearmy.org got involved with the coal miners who were fighting earlier this year to get their health care saved because the coal industry had basically erased their pensions and their health care benefits, and they were, you know, about to fall off a cliff. We joined forces with the coal miners. We got the federal government to step in and to save their health care, 20,000 coal miners, some with black lung disease, et cetera. You know, in the process, I learned a lot about how we come across. And some of the best, smartest people I've met in the past year have been, you know, white, male, heterosexual, cisgendered Trump voters who are fully aware that whatever we put on our websites and whatever policies we say, that there is an underlying almost condescension or almost contempt for them. And it's very hard to vote for people, even if they got the right policies on their website, if you sense that they don't respect you or don't like you. For instance, a lot of African Americans are actually quite conservative. You know, the two strongest institutions in the black community, the church and hip hop. You know, hip hop, nobody raps about being on welfare. They rap about, you know, money and aspiration and trying to make it or whatever. You know, a kind of a entrepreneurial work ethic, you know, powers hip hop. You know, the church obviously has a lot of socially conservative things. Well, then why don't half of the African Americans then vote for Republicans? Because Republicans never miss the opportunity to miss an opportunity to show respect to African Americans. Every time you watch Fox, it's some disrespectful stuff. And so even though some of their policies and even some of their values might appeal to African Americans, their underlying contempt for African Americans blocks their path with us. And I think without knowing it and without meaning to, and I talk about this in the book, there are ways that we, you know, we kind of put down people who are from certain parts of the country. It's almost like it's a fashionable thing to say, oh, these kind of uneducated, ignorant, backwater people. It's almost, sometimes I'm afraid that we sound almost like colonizers, you know, talking about a third world country or a developing country when we talk about red state America. And that contempt is how you get somebody like a Hillary Clinton, who is a genius's genius, saying something like, oh, half of Trump's voters are deplorable. Well, hold on a second. You're talking about 30 million Americans are deplorable? Half? Nobody in your on your team said, wait a minute, you're talking about my mom, my grandma, my stepdad? What are you talking about? The fact that that never got, you know, vetted gives you a sense that it's almost fashionable to look down on certain people. And as long as it's fine for us to disagree, but we don't have to disrespect or disregard. And in some ways it sounds so kindergarten, but when you have the entire leadership class now flunking kindergarten, it's a problem. And you got to talk about that before you even can get to the policies.
But is there an equivalency between, and I couldn't agree with you more, that Secretary Clinton's remarks about deplorability were a bad political strategy. On the other hand, of course, there are an awful lot of people, and we saw them night after night at Trump rallies, acting in a deplorable way. And is there, yes, an equivalency between the kind of deplorable behavior of Donald Trump and the behavior, deplorable or not, depending on your perspective, of Hillary Clinton during the general election campaign? I mean, there was a nightly barrage of impolite, discourteous, hateful, bigoted, arrogant speech coming from the Republican, yes, candidate for president. I mean, do we run the risk of saying, well, here are these two people who are equally wrong on either side of the spectrum?
You know, this is a particular thing that when I've noticed as I'm trying to promote the book, and you might have to help me with this. Whenever I try to explain ways that we could have done better, I get accused of making a false equivalence. And the problem that I have is I don't know how to discuss ways for us to improve. I think I spent a lot of time in the past half an hour explaining exactly how much I cannot stand and hate what Donald Trump stands for. Mm-hmm. The only person in the country that I will insult directly is Donald Trump. He's an orange weirdo. I don't even try with him. But at the same time, I feel like, you know, with my kids, you know, we have like a soccer game and they lose. You know, it's then they're very upset and they're frustrated and they're complaining about the other team. They're complaining about the referee. They're complaining about Comey. They're complaining about the FBI. I'm like, guys, yes, all that's true. But we still have to look in the mirror what could we have done better today where we might have won despite all that? Mm-hmm. And that's what's in my heart. And I feel like this, and I don't mean to be rude, but there's a chorus that rises up, I think, inside of each liberal, each progressive, each Democrat. The minute that we start, you know, trying to self-reflect, there's a fear we're going to let Donald Trump off the hook, false equivalence. Here's the deal. The only way we're going to improve, even if we're only 5% in the wrong, is to look at that 5%, mm-hmm. and that's what I'm trying to go
yeah,
for.
Yeah, that's a good point. Van Jones, his book is called Beyond the Messy Truth, How We Came Apart, How We Come Together. Our phone number here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Let's try to sneak a couple phone calls in here. Jay Allen from Emmitsburg, welcome to Midday with Van Jones.
Yes, hi. Great show, as always. The discussion has moved on considerably from what I wanted to comment on, but at the same time that President Obama was winning two presidential elections, the Democrats were crushed in the Senate and crushed in the House and crushed even worse at the state level. And so with that kind of a dynamic, it's difficult for me to see how any kind of the dialogue that you propose is even going to be possible. So I'll listen to comment off the air. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, I mean, if ever there were a moment for self-reflection, this is it, given what has been lost in terms of, you know, the political movement on the left. But again, you still remain hopeful.
Well, I do remain hopeful because, I mean, I can't tell you how much I appreciate the caller's, you know, insight. Under the 8 years of Obama, when probably most of the listeners, including, you know, myself often, were very, very happy with America and felt very, very good, as we were kind of sitting there in that Obama bubble bath, we lost the House, we lost the Senate, we lost two-thirds of the state legislatures, we lost two-thirds of the governorship, we lost 1,000 offices, state and federal, and nobody knew we were in trouble until election night 2016. Now, that gives you a sense that there's something wrong. We say, oh, well, how disconnected from reality are these Trump voters? They believe all this crazy stuff, and they don't understand that Trump's not fit. Okay, true. And maybe that's 95% of the problem. But how disconnected are we from reality when you have a party in free fall collapse for 8 years and nobody notices, and we somehow think we're going to win in 2016 when we've lost every other election that didn't have Obama at the top of the ticket? So for me, I'm very, you know, committed, you know, going forward. I think we need better conservatives and better Republicans. We need better Democrats and better progressives. But the only way you get better is to look in the mirror. Now, you say, where's the reason for hope? I mean, first of all, I don't understand how the despair crowd is going to sustain itself. The people who are just waking up every day at, you know, 7:59 a.m., they pick up their phone, they look, oh my God, Trump tweeted again, and they spend the rest of their day upset. My question is, how are they going to sustain themselves? That is not sustainable. What I'm saying is that the majority of people in the United States, the vast majority, are not with Steve Bannon. They're not neo-Nazis. You know, they're conservatives who, just like there are a bunch of progressives that voted for Hillary Clinton but don't believe in everything Hillary Clinton stands for, there are a bunch of conservatives that voted for Donald Trump that don't believe in everything he stands for. And yet we're acting as if we fought a hard campaign and we didn't. We're acting as if, you know, half the country are Nazis and they're not. And then therefore all hope is lost. And I think to go from hopey, hopey, hopey in 2008 to mopey, mopey, mopey in 2016, they were both mistakes. You know, let's just get on with the work. Like I said, my book is full of stuff that people can actually do. Issues that we can champion, groups that we can support. We're going to get our muscles back by mobilizing and doing real work, sometimes across issues, sometimes, you know, against the president. But let's get on with it, and let's just quit. You know, this daily outrage stuff is getting really, really tedious.
When you talk about bipartisanship that has happened when it's, you know, small pools of it have broken out for whatever reason. You talk about that it's been bipartisanship of, by, and for the elites. The word elite is a word that's very much in the common parlance now. I mean, Steve Bannon is calling Mitch McConnell and his cronies in the Senate elites. What do you mean by elites? Do you think there is a consensus about who the elites are and the damage that they're doing?
I think there's a growing one. I mean, I am an elite. You know, I grew up in the rural South on the edge of a small town, but I got a chance to go to Yale for law school. I'm pretty well paid by CNN. I've traveled the world. That's not most people. Most people in this country don't have college degrees. You know, the median income in this country is, you know, below $50,000 a year for a family of, I think, three or four. I mean, so, yeah, I mean, so yes, there is an elite in our society. Everybody knows that. There's some people, you know, Hollywood, New York, Silicon Valley, Wall Street, D.C. Yes, there's an elite. But just because you have an elite doesn't mean you have to pursue elitist policy or be elitist in attitude. So the problem isn't really the elite, it's the elitism in policy. And you did have, and I, you know, don't understand why we don't just start every conversation with this, there was an elite bipartisan consensus at the top of both parties for ideas and policies that were just stupid. I mean, we agreed to these, I mean, you know, both parties were for NAFTA and these trade deals and then overpromised on how much job training and other opportunity there was going to be. It worked out well for some, but for the people who got hurt in those trade deals, they were devastated. Those towns are ghost towns. It is horrible. Both parties said we could deregulate the banks and nothing bad would happen. And in less than 10 years, we had a crisis that wiped out a million homes and $1 trillion. Both parties said we should build prisons from coast to coast, and that's how we're going to deal with drugs. And it has been a catastrophe for black and brown communities. Both parties said we could be in these wars and it'd be okay. And listen, all of these ideas were terrible, and they were opposed by grassroots people from the beginning, and people were ignored. And so when you have that level of an elite bipartisan failure at the top, you are going to have a backlash and a rebellion. And you saw in the Democratic Party that rebellion took the form of Bernie Sanders and Black Lives Matter. And in the Republican Party, that rebellion took the form first of the Tea Party and then ultimately of Trump. And we have to acknowledge, we can't pretend that all of these movements that, you know, have kind of, you know, from Occupy Wall Street to whatever, have just come out of nowhere. It's come out of the fact that, you know, this kind of neoliberal, pro-globalization, you know, set of ideas and neoconservative, you know, foreign adventures hurt the country, hurt tens of millions of people. And so now the question is, you know, going forward, do we turn to each other or do we turn on each other? Donald Trump is aggressively trying to make sure that we turn on each other and that poor white folks are mad at poor black folks and scared Muslims and new, you know, newly arrived Latinos, and that the common pain never leads to truly common purpose. And this book is directed at, you know, that at the challenge of us, the good people in both parties, not just giving up and surrendering to the cynicism. You know, presidents have tremendous spiritual power, which we never talk about. But, you know, a JFK got everybody excited about the Peace Corps, and everybody wanted to be a part of that because he had that power. You know, Reagan had people, you know, really respecting Wall Street because he had that power. Obama, under Obama, even the Republicans stopped fighting so hard against marriage equality because, you know, he was putting out that kind of inclusive tone. Now Trump is here, and everybody's acting like jackasses. All of us are getting pulled down to his level of just cynicism and nastiness. And, you know, I just say enough, enough. I'm not going to let the country I'm raising my children in become a mirror image of him in both parties if I can do something about it.
Van Jones, the new book is called The Messy Truth, How We Came Apart, How We Come Together. Van Jones will be talking about his book Wednesday night at MICA. I'll have details about that event later in today's show. And we'll have more with Van Jones after we take a break. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and to find us on Twitter, @MiddayTomHall. Before we take that break on Mondays, it's our custom here on Midday to read the names of the people who have lost their lives to violence in Baltimore during the previous week. We do so to stand in solidarity with their families in their hour of grief. So far this year, 282 people in Baltimore City have been killed. Last week, 7 people were the victims of homicide in our city. Two are men whom police have yet to identify. The others are James Stedman IV, age 26, Anthony Foster, age 31, Daryl Singletary, age 43, Christopher Yancey Sr., age 33, and Dondre McLaughlin. He was 19 years old. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest today is Van Jones, the CNN commentator and host of The Messy Truth with Van Jones. His new book is called Beyond the Messy Truth, How We Came Apart, How We Come Together. You're welcome to join us at 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. And Van Jones, I owe you my profound apologies. I think a couple of times I've given the title of your book wrong. I've called it The Messy Truth. In fact, and this is the whole point of the book, it's Beyond the Messy Truth. You're trying to get past where we are.
So, yeah, trying to, so, desperately.
Yeah. So we have an email here from David who says, for 150 years, the left has been in the habit of thinking of themselves as outlaws or the underground. But if Trump succeeds in what he appears to be pursuing, developing his marginal base into a cadre of supporters willing to hit the streets, they will be the outlaws opposed by the left, the center, and the moderate right, as well as the business community. How does the left learn to own their new mainstream status? So I guess he's saying that the left is now a little more mainstream than it used to be, and it's the Trump base, so-called, that's at the extreme.
Well, there's some wisdom to that, and what it would call for is us to grow up a little bit in the way that, you know, Mandela insisted that his movement grow up. There was a while when the ANC, you know, they were the outsiders, they were the underdogs. And then when he got out of prison, he started telling the young people, don't prepare to protest. Don't just prepare to protest. Prepare to govern. And there's a bit of part, there's an attitude among some of the progressives that, you know, really does arise out of our own personal experience of having been oppressed and discriminated against and persecuted, whether you're LGBTQ or whether you're female or whether you come from the disability community, whether you're African American, Latino, the whole list of us, you know, Native Americans, you know, Muslims. And out of that experience, there is a need to stand up and to push back and to fight back and to speak our truths. And yet, if that's all we do, we can sometimes create an atmosphere where tribalisms, both on the left and throughout the country, gain a little bit too much purchase. And then you have the white people saying, well, we're going to be tribal too, and that doesn't work. So what you've got to be able to figure out how to do, and Lord knows this is the hardest problem in Democratic, small d, politics, is to both stick up for your own group and make sure that your own group's interests are protected and promoted, and yet at the same time do it on a basis and in a way that keeps the door open for a bigger circle and for more inclusion and for more cohesion. This is hard to do when you have someone like a Donald Trump and a Bannon deliberately trying to inflame and distract and divide the country every second of every day. And yet, Mandela found a way to do it. He was able to say, even to his opponents, the white Afrikaners, who had imposed apartheid, imposed racism and segregation and killed people and tortured people, he was able to say to them, I need you. I need you. There's a South Africa that I'm trying to build. Even though I'm Xhosa, I need to see the Zulus thriving. I need to see the Fula rising. I need to see even the Afrikaners. I need you to be at your greatest so we can make this miracle happen in our country. And he was able to persuade enough of them, not all of them, but enough of them to make that transition to democracy. Well, we've got to make a transition, you know, to a functional democracy, because we've now, the wheels are off the road. And the first steps toward a failing democracy are rampant tribalisms and a dysfunctional government. And we've got both of them right now. And so progressives now have a completely unfair task. We have to lift up our own constituents who are being beaten down. We've got to reach out to try to, if we can't build bridges, at least de-inflame some of the tensions that, you know, with our opponents. And we have to find a way forward for the whole country. That's tough when you're getting beat up every day and you feel like the world's against you. But that's really what's required, and other people have done it around the world. I think we have to raise our standard, not lower it and just be mad all day at Trump, but raise it and think about how do we build a coalition that's big enough and beautiful enough to govern and pull enough of his people back over to us that this never happens again.
Let's try to get another call in. Michael in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Van Jones.
Great. Thanks, Tom. I appreciate it. I actually, you've touched on a couple other topics since I first called in, so I have maybe two additional comments in addition to the original question.
Well, just make them quick and we'll be grateful. Thanks.
Yeah, so as far as the daily outrage, I just wanted to present a perspective that justifies that. Is that I remember the Washington Post and some other polls had come out last year indicating that so much of the voting was racialized, whether it was immigration, homeland security, or incarceration and crime. Since so many people are voting and thinking with these racialized attitudes, how could we expect them to collaborate with Democrats or collaborate with those minority communities when in their heart of hearts there's still an opposition to that person doing better? And so even though there are all these shared goals, just like it's been for centuries in America, there's still a lot of white people, majority white people, who are unwilling to cooperate in a way that allows or promotes minority benefit while reaching those goals.
All right, Van, you want to take that?
Yes, I think the danger is always overinterpreting the whole situation we're in based on the outcome of one really bad and weird election. The same country has, you're correct, the majority of white people voted for Barack Obama and against Hillary Clinton. The majority of white people, by the way, also voted against Barack Obama both times. The majority of white people in every state voted against Barack Obama both times. The majority of white people in California voted against Barack Obama both times. But we were still able to put together a governing coalition, at least, you know, for at the presidential level, and to make some real progress. And so what I would say is, yes, it is very, very hard, and you have people out there who are deliberately inflaming these tensions. But I still believe that a bipartisanship from below is possible if we focus on some of the issues that bring us together. It's amazing how infectious it gets when, you know, you work with some, you know, some a bunch of people. You never thought you'd get along with them. You had all these different fears and anxieties, and you start working together, and it starts to feel good. And then it's just harder to go back to the same old nonsense. And so just like hatred can spread like a virus as it is spreading this very moment, which is outrageous and is unacceptable, let's not forget that love can spread too. And we have to be the one. It's completely unfair to you or to me or to any of us to have to put up with this level of crap and attack every day and have to rise above it and be the big people. But guess what? The present environment means we're going to have more Trumpism, not less. It is unfair, but we have the responsibility to up-level. And part of that, when you're talking about the opioid epidemic, when you're talking about criminal justice, when you're talking about, you know, kids not being properly educated, and these other issues that we talk about in the book, start working below. Don't worry about Mitch McConnell and these guys. My God, they don't know what they're doing, and who knows what's going to become of any of them. But we can start working now across some of these lines, you know, at the local level. And also, don't forget, just tweeting and being outraged and posting on Facebook is not the work. I mean, part of what's happening
is
so many progressives are just, we're not even just volunteering in our own communities to just, you know, help kids or clean up parks or just do all the work we used to do. It's become a social media addicted liberal movement, the same way you see what's going on with Trump. And so, you know, and if we're out there, I promise you this, exercising our rights, working hard on issues, getting away from social media, getting away from these despairing conversations that never lead to a single solution, even just among each other, we're going to feel better. And it's going to start to be attractive again. And it's going to be a where people want to be a part of it. And if we reach out on a couple of issues, we can, listen, these most of these Republicans will be Republicans till they die. They're going to vote against us. We're going to vote against them. But they don't have to hate us, and we don't have to hate them. And they can vote for better Republicans who might actually be willing to do something. Vote for Republicans, but don't vote for these people you're voting for now. You've got some of the worst people ever born winning elections in the Republican Party. And they, and if I gave them a deal, 99% would help their Republican base, but 1% would help a Muslim, they turn the whole deal down. That's not conservative. That's just anti-liberal. Yeah, you've got an anti-liberal party, and that's got to stop.
You make the point in the book, and I think this is a really interesting notion. You bring up the sort of theology or philosophy that's a big part of the Black church, that there's a difference, a distinction between happiness and joy. And I wonder, yes, is unhappiness the reason for the discontent that we've experienced in the way the vote broke down last November? Because a lot of people have attributed it to fear. What's the distinction there between unhappiness, fear, joy, optimism?
Well, I mean, what I was writing about was, you know, I was on the ground in Ferguson. I was on the ground in Charleston, South Carolina, where that young racist went in there and shot up a whole church and killed 9 unarmed, innocent African-Americans. And I was just talking about my struggle with that and how much anger I felt, and really hatred. And yet the people who went to that church stepped forward and said that they forgave the shooter. They didn't want him to have the death penalty. They're still fighting, even though he got the death penalty, to keep him alive. And they were singing this incredibly beautiful music. And Jake Tapper asked me on the air, like, well, why do they sound so happy? And I said, you know, in the Black church, there's a distinction between happiness and joy. Happiness is a response to external positive events, but joy is something that's inside you. It's a celebration of the fact that no matter how low they push you, you're still a child of God, you still have worth, you still have value, and you're not going to let your opponents take that from you, whatever else they take. And so that joy in that music, and unfortunately, Black folks have had to learn to find that, because there's been so much pain and misery and oppression and injustice. And yet parts of our community have come through whole and intact with something beautiful to share for the whole world. And I grew up in those churches. I come out of that tradition. And I'm not going to throw it in the garbage can for Donald Trump. That's a tradition that Dr. King comes out of. It is a tradition that Michelle Obama grew up with, and that Obama took refuge in. It's a tradition that has something to offer the country. And so for, you know, those of us who come from communities, Native American, African American, and others that have had to deal with very bad presidents for a very long time, I think it might be wise to just keep that perspective.
Yeah, and Van, we're going to have to make that the last word. I apologize. We are out of time. I'll leave you with this thought. Shirley in Arbutus says, please announce your run for president. So if you want to think about politics as a gig, you got one supporter in Arbutus. But thank you for your time today, man. I really appreciate it. This book gives us a lot to think about.
Thank you, sir.
Van Jones will discuss the new book, Beyond the Messy Truth, Wednesday night at the Brown Center on the campus of the Maryland Institute College of Art. It's part of the Writers Live series produced by the Enoch Pratt Library. It starts at 7. It's a ticketed event. We'll have link to details at wypr.org/midday. Thanks to The Diz for supplying lunch today. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner, with breakfast served on the weekends, on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Elizabeth Strout spends the hour with us. Hope you'll join us tomorrow here on Midday. I'm Tom Hall for the entire Midday team. Really appreciate your listening. Have a great day.